The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 540 for Sunday, February 15th, 2015.
And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in the questions, the tips, the cool stuff found. We answer the questions, we share the tips, we discuss the cool stuff found, which is what we did last week. I don't think we have any cool stuff found this week. And the goal is to learn a lot every single time we come together here and have some fun while we're doing it. Our first sponsor for this episode is Lynda at lynda.com/mgg. That's the URL you visit to get a full 10-day free trial of Lynda's entire offering. So you got to check that out. We'll talk more about that in the show. Also, sponsor for this episode, Barebones Software at barebones.com, makers of fine software like BB Edit, like Yojimbo. We'll talk a little bit more about those later in the show, too, here. And no longer snowing, Durham, New Hampshire, at least for the moment. I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in chilly, windy, very windy, Fairfield, Connecticut, this is John F. Braun.
Yeah, it's bitter cold out there. Actually, it's not that bitter. I mean, I say that, John. When I woke up this morning, or when I got downstairs this morning, it was 18 degrees, which is quite a bit warmer than the single digit and negative single digit Fahrenheit temperatures that we saw. Yeah, 18 degrees Fahrenheit. But we were seeing temperatures right around zero, within 5 degrees on either side all week long in the mornings. So 18 degrees in the morning is not a bad thing. I guess we're going in the right direction. But I have to figure out how to solve my ice dams, John. I've never had them before. And it's not good. So that's yet another geek gab topic. Not necessarily Mac geek gab topic, but I need house geek gab, I guess.
Yeah, I'd get a professional to do that.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's much you can do. I mean, there's some you can do. The first thing I got to do is get the snow off the roof, which I will. And then it's a matter of, do I want to put those little discs up with the calcium chloride in them to melt some? I just need to melt some tracks in the ice dam so that when everything starts to melt, the water has somewhere to go and doesn't just, you know, try and seep its way into my house. That's the real trick. Yeah.
That's the good stuff. That's what I use. Calcium chloride.
Yeah. They say if you have ice dams, I was reading about it, you can buy these little things or whatever that are built to do it. And you just throw them, you toss them up onto your roof above the ice dam. No. And then it, you know, it melts through. But they say if you want to do it yourself, what you get is pantyhose, old pantyhose or new pantyhose. It doesn't really matter. And you put calcium chloride in about 4-inch lengths of that and tie it off at either end and then just throw that up on your roof and it'll, you know, make it's the same thing. Just, you know, some sort of permeable sausage for it, I guess, is what that would be. Anyway, that's not what we're talking about today, or at least that's not what we're going to talk about anymore today.
No, I want to talk about one new thing that I just ran into. All sorts of new things.
I hope you didn't run into anything in your car, though.
Oh, no.
Okay, good.
No, those days have passed.
Let's hope.
When I was a young driver, I tended to run into things.
Yeah. I was with you once. Twice, I guess.
When we hit that guy that flipped his truck. Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, we were lucky to survive.
All I got to say is I am glad that we were driving a big piece of American metal.
No,
I
mean, kidding. Cheers to that.
That Cordoba was a tank.
Yeah. Yeah. This podcast would not exist today if you had chosen to drive a smaller car with less weight. Folks, we were years and years before Mac Geek Gab was ever even a twinkle in our eyes. We were driving along. It was a New England road, speed limits maybe 45 or so. It was at night, in the fall, foggy, single lane on either side, you know, so two lanes of traffic in opposing directions. And it was foggy. And you get used to that in New England and you see fog and, you know, and so you just kind of drive through it. And I remember sitting in the passenger seat, John, you know, we're cruising along and I don't think you were going. I mean, maybe you were going 50, but, you know, you weren't speeding or anything in an egregious way. And obviously we hit fog and then there was red light in the fog. Bam. And now we're still driving along. We look at each other like, you okay? Yep. You okay? Yep. And then I remember you saying, John, I can't really steer. Like, okay, well, we need to figure out what just happened. And yeah, some guy's truck had flipped over in the other lane, coming the other way, and slid into our lane. I mean, if we were 2 seconds later, his truck hit your car like on the front, like just the very front corner enough that, you know, but if he was 2 more feet into our lane, it would have changed everything, man.
Oh yeah. And I even remember his insurance company. They were like, oh, you evaded. You drove. I'm like, how would I know to call you to file a claim if
seriously?
I evaded? Yeah. Oh yeah. No, it was a real scummy insurance company. I'm wow. like, look, you know,
we're talking
fault.
No evasion. Yeah. The tow truck driver. I mean, yeah, we were there. We didn't see the guy. He had more problems. He had, I guess what had happened, he was coming the other way really fast. I mean, like super fast, and swerved to avoid a deer or something.
So he claims.
Yeah. Well, that happens. I mean, that's a reasonable mm-hmm. claim at that time of year. And I guess went up on the bank. So for us, the road was kind of in the middle of a hill, and to the right of us was the hill went down. And obviously to his right, the hill went up. And so he went up on the hill and then rolled his truck onto its side and slid. They said he slid like, you know, 100 feet. How fast do you have to be going to slide a truck on its side 100 feet? I mean, that's he must have been cooking. Anyway, we were right. fortunate. Yeah. But that's not the only
thing
collision
I'm telling
we were
you
in.
About.
Remember, we were in the traffic circle in Revere, Mass there.
Oh, yeah. When the guy... Yeah, when the guy creamed us in the rotary.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, that was nice.
He was like, "Your fault." I'm like, "Well, no,
don't think so."
I was ahead of you. You kind of ran into me. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway,
alrighty. So the new thing. So initially, so you know, I'm logging into Skype and it wasn't working. I saw a call, and then all of a sudden, nothing. And I'm like, "What happened?" I'll tell you what happened, Dave. Is I had changed my password. Why did you do that, John? Well, I'll tell you why I did that. So the other day I noticed this is a relatively new feature in LastPass, and I think it's a good feature. I noticed this just the other day. I was on one of the screens in the in my browser with the LastPass extension, and I noticed this button that I hadn't seen before, change password automatically. This is a new feature that they have implemented. It doesn't work on every site, but it works on a lot of sites, and basically you click the button, and it... You click the button and it logs into the site. It generates a strong password per the parameters that you've defined for LastPass.
Sure.
And just changes it for you.
That's pretty cool, man. Huh.
It is. It's a good. And I think they introduced it in December. I just hadn't noticed. But yeah, no, it works great. So, you know, it's a good idea to, you know, take that into account because. Yeah, some of my passwords are, you know, could be better.
Right.
And using LastPass, you know, it's effortless. It just, you know, kind of magically happens in the background.
That's awesome. Wow. That's pretty cool. Good stuff. I like it. All right. Let's go to Ralph here. Ralph wrote in this week. He says, I'm gearing up to buy a brand new late 2014 27-inch non-retina iMac for the family. My question is about the optional Fusion Drive. Do you, either of you, have any personal experience with those? What's the verdict? Do they hold up? Do they perform as touted? Last boot time, fast boot time ups get, man, let's see if we can do that again. Fast boot up times, yet lots of storage. There we are. Based on my experience of putting SSDs in my MacBooks, I know I want the boot up speed they offer, but I cannot afford the large solid state drives that will provide the kind of storage I need. So I'm considering the 1 terabyte Fusion Drive. Any thoughts on their merits? You know, I have yet to set up a Fusion Drive here, John. The iMac that I have in front of me, the 2011 iMac, was released just before the Fusion Drives were an option. And so it's not really an option on this, though, of course, you can set one up manually. And when I got my Retina iMac, I got it with a 512 gig SSD, so or a 500 gig, I guess they call it, SSD. And so there's no Fusion Drive in that. This one in front of me has a 256 gig SSD and the 1 terabyte spindle drive. So it has the hardware for a Fusion drive. I just manage it separately. And, you know, I should set one up for the purposes of testing for this show, but I can't bring myself to do it. It's probably because I'm a geek, but, you know, I spent years and years setting up networks and such where we were doing multiple spindles and RAID drives and all that stuff. And the drives fail. And when you have more than one hardware component comprising a volume, which is what a Fusion drive is, it's the fusion of an SSD, typically a 128 gig SSD when Apple does it by default, and then in this case, a 1 terabyte Fusion spindle. When you do that, there is no fault tolerance. So if one fails, everything's gone. Now that's true if you only have one hard drive as well. If one fails, everything's gone. I just feel like there's more opportunity for failure there. I may be wrong on this, but I prefer to manage things my own. I think you are going to get better speeds if you manage it manually and put things that you know you want on the SSD there, as opposed to going with Apple's in the background logic to decide. Though I think Apple's in the background logic will do some of what you would do on your own, which includes putting the majority of the boot stuff on the SSD so that you get that startup speed. So what are your thoughts? I know you're not running a Fusion drive either, John, but I'm curious as to your thoughts.
I don't know. I got drives, haven't really dabbled with it. I have no thoughts. I guess I am running something that's redundant, and actually something just came up here.
Well, hey, hang on. Let's go there in a second, but let's stay on track for a second. So, clearly you have thoughts on the subject. Would you run a Fusion drive on your own, or would you manage it separately?
I don't think I'd really consider it. I like to have everything on one drive, honestly.
Oh, but a Fusion drive gives you that end appearance, right? Because it's one volume that
right.
is managed in the background, which is what you like. But would you do it with I guess it's striped is the wrong word. It's spanned disks, right? Where you've effectively got, you know, your data is only in one of the two disks, but you just can't control which two. So I'm just curious as to your thoughts. You know, if you were buying a new iMac, would you get it with a Fusion drive?
No.
Okay. There you go.
No, and an iMac maybe in my future, and I think I just get it with a large enough drive. I mean, you know, like I did here on the MacBook. I mean,
sure.
You know, 1 terabyte SSD for, you know, $300.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah. That's the choice I made. I am running.
Yeah. Now sense. I want to hear. Yeah.
Well, I am running something that is, I guess you could say it's Fusion like. So for this machine, I actually have a RAID set. I used the Disutility to create a mirrored volume.
Oh.
That I have a USB drive. I have this. So I have two drives. One is a FireWire 800, which I'm like, what am I going to do with this thing? You know, it's a fairly old iOmega, like 300 gig. And I also have a USB drive, both, you know, the smaller form factor, 2.5 inch, I guess. I'm like, huh, why don't I make that a RAID set and do a carbon copy cloner backup to it daily? You know, I have it wake up, I think, you know, 2 a.m, creates a backup, and then it goes to sleep. And it was interesting because actually what came up the other day is DrivePulse came up and said, you know, this iOmega drive here, it's got some bad blocks. So I'm like, thank goodness I did a mirrored set.
Yeah.
And that, so that drive is starting to fail. So I'm going to have to toss that drive and put another one there in the mirrored set.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, that, you know, that I like, right? Fault tolerance. You've got two, you know, drives of questionable origin. Not questionable, but, you know, great history, long in the tooth. And so you've got them backing each other up, so to speak. I like that. We had a discussion after Ralph's question came in earlier this week on our Facebook group for about this. And there's some interesting thoughts. No one has had any serious problems with Fusion drives over time. I'm hoping that someone will post some benchmarks on their Fusion Drive from the from like a Blackmagic speed test or something. So hopefully that'll show up this week during in that group. And if you've got a Fusion Drive and you're interested, Blackmagic is a freely available from the App Store, Blackmagic disk speed test, and is awesome. So check out that group and download Blackmagic and then post your results. We'd love to, I'd love to hear, because it is, I mean, on the surface, it's very attractive, right? You know, you if you can truly get the speed of the SSD when you want it, and then everything else is there. Because right, what I'm doing downstairs is I've just got things on two separate drives, and I've got my music library and my photo. Actually, my photos I moved internal. But, you know, I've got my music library and things like that on the external drive, and things that I don't really care about speed with. And then I'm booting, and my documents and my apps and all that stuff are launching and running from the SSD. Fun. Funny, funny drives. All right. McKay wrote, says, OS X Finder and Mission Control don't seem to be aware of each other's existence and can't work together. He says, I'm running Yosemite on my Mac Mini, and with all of my other applications, Mission Control and Finder, Mission Control interacts with the following way. One can engage Mission Control and drag a window of, say, Safari onto another space, and the Safari window will migrate to that space. Additionally, if one moves horizontally left or right with the control left or right arrow, our Safari window will stay on the space it belongs and look to slide away from us, which is how spaces work. And spaces can actually be really cool things. I don't run them, but I know a lot of people do. I probably should run them. But it can be a great way to kind of manage your workspace. He says, however, Finder doesn't do any of these things. When enabling Mission Control and dragging Finder to another space at the top of the screen, the Finder window refuses to be moved and goes right back to where it started when released. Additionally, when swiping left or right on the desktop, the open Finder window will just appear on the next space in the exact same location. All other apps except the Finder work fine. Maybe it's a prefs issue? I don't know. So, yeah, I think it is a prefs issue, and I think it's a pretty easy one. If you right-click, the only way I know how to get there is this. There might be another way, but if you right-click on your Finder icon in the dock and go to Options and see what's set for Assign To, my guess is that it says All Desktops, and you probably want it to be on None. If you have it set to All Desktops, then it will do exactly what it's doing. Finder will appear on all desktops. And I'm not sure. Like I said, I don't run spaces, but I feel like this might be a default for the Finder, because you might want your files available. It seems reasonable that of all the apps that exist, the Finder might be one where you kind of want that on every space, so that, you know, when you've got files moving around, you're not having to go to a different space to find them, as it were. But yeah, you can turn that off. You can put it on None, and then it will only be on the space that you've put it on. Use spaces, John?
No, I find it too confusing.
Yeah.
I'd get lost.
Yeah, I do it occasionally on my MacBook Air, where I obviously have, you know, an 11-inch screen, so limited real estate. And it works fine. I find more helpful, and it is using spaces to a degree, is just doing full screen with some apps. I'll have Safari running full screen or Mail running full screen, and that works fine. You know, another thing, while we're on this subject, John, that I wanted to bring up, there were a couple things that I've had in the Mac Gab queue, but one of them is, you know, when I moved to Yosemite, I just left things the way they were. When I helped my son set up a new machine we were setting up for him, he went into all the preferences because he was curious. You know, he's 13 and he wanted to go through all that stuff. And he turned on dark menu and dock mode. And man, I'll tell you what, I love it. I now have dark menu mode enabled on all of my machines. And that's in System Preferences, General, right there on the first tab. There's a checkbox that says use dark menu bar and dock. I really, really like it, because what happens, and I like it on my 11-inch and I like it on my 27-inch. It makes the windows pop. Because the screens these days mostly have black bezels, what it does is it makes the menu bar really just kind of fade away into the into the bezel of the screen, and it makes all your windows really pop out. And it didn't take me very long to get used to it at all. In fact, it was immediately I liked it. So I highly recommend checking it out. You may not like it, but it is worth checking it out. So I'll leave that. That's I've got other tips too, but you know, that's the one I've been meaning to share. So have you tried it yet, John? Do you use it?
Yeah, I checked it out and I'm like, I'm okay with the way it normally is.
Yeah, I felt that way in the beginning when I first saw it, either in the betas or whatever, you know, whenever I first turned it on, I was like, yeah, that's interesting. I turned it off. But as soon as I saw my son kind of driving around with it, I was like, oh, I get this now. You know, I kind of had to have a little bit of a forest from the trees approach before I fully grokked the beauty of it. Hey, I want to talk about our first sponsor, John, which is Lynda at lynda.com/MGG. That's the URL you go to in order to get a 10-day free trial of Lynda's fantastic courses on all kinds of topics. They now have over 3,000 courses. And these aren't just courses that they've developed over, you know, the decade plus that they've been doing this. That some of them are, but they're always up to date. So they have expired courses that don't apply these days. So when I say they have 3,000 courses, it's 3,000 relevant courses. Now, not all of them are going to be relevant to you. You may not be interested in accounting. You probably are. And if you are, that's a great place to go, right? But you might be interested in web development. There you go. Photography. You want to learn Photoshop? Great. Check it out. And these are video courses. They are so well done. I mean, these people that create these courses are professionals. They are experts in their field, and they go through, they do the course, and you're either seeing the instructor because it's a video course, or you'll see the instructor in courses where that makes sense. But also if you're learning something like say Photoshop, you will be, shown the screen and you get to see what's happening. So you're not just having someone tell you, hey, here's what you do. Here's the button you click. You know, for example, if somebody was showing you, if you take the course on OS X Yosemite, you don't just hear somebody like me telling you, okay, go to system preferences, go do this. You will see it happen on the screen and you can follow along too. In fact, and this is all part of all available as part of your 10-day free trial. You can watch the courses on your iPad and your iPhone too, if you like. So you get your iPad up, you've got the course there, they're cooking along, and you've got the sound, you've got the video, and then you've got your Mac right next to you, and you can just go back and forth. So, you know, there's no commitment required here. Lynda.com, lynda.com/MGG. You go there, you sign up, and you take a course. You take one course and forget about it. And, you know, you don't owe them anything. You get 10 whole days of all of it. And really, really well done courses. They've got course materials that go along with them. Obviously, some courses have more than others because in some courses that's relevant. You've got a transcript going of the entire course as it happens. So if you're like, wait, what did they say? You can just go back and read it. It kind of has a little sing along with Mitch style thing where it highlights the words if you want. Each course is chopped up into chapters. You can have those chapters just auto flow from one to the other, or you can have it stop at the end of the chapter. If you know that you know, like that OS X Yosemite thing, I'd want to have a little break where, okay, I learned about this. Now I just want to poke around and check out some of this stuff that I've learned. And then you're going to go back and you hit play and you continue on. So you got to check this out. Lynda.com, lynda.com/MGG. And I want to hear about it. You know, we're a month into 2015 here. John and I, we want to hear about what you've learned from Lynda. So go sign up for the trial and then tell us what you've learned. We'd love to hear about it. And we'll talk about it on the show. We've got some more Lynda spots coming up, of course, and we'll talk about it. So thank you to you for doing that in advance. And thank you to Lynda for sponsoring the show and supporting what we do here. lynda.com/MGG. John, you want to take us to Sean?
Yeah. Right. Though I'll say personally, Dave, I'm 2 months into the year. I don't know what calendar are you on? You said you were a month into the year.
Well, we're a month and a half, right? Okay. I mean, it's February 15th, right? So, right. You know.
Yeah. All right. So here we go. We had a question, and actually this is relevant because I had to do this, or I just did this, Dave, to one of my older machines here. So the question is from Sean, and he says, I have a 2007 17-inch MacBook Pro that is running Mountain Lion. I want to wipe all my personal information off of it, keeping the OS, so that I can sell it. What's the best way to do this? Well, one thing you can do, Dave, and actually I did this, so I have the MacBook Pro. So I finally put it back together. You know, it was in pieces because I took the drive out and put it in my new machine. Or at least that's what I did. And then, you know, I finally decided, you know what, I'm going to, you know, I'll probably go to Gazelle or someone and sell it. Or maybe I'll sell it to you for parts or something like that. You know, we'll see how that works out. But basically, sure. But that machine actually came with CDs, you know, those round things.
Oh, yeah, that's
so
right.
So the Macs used to come with CDs that would include the OS that, you know, that was current at the time. And actually, that's what I did with this machine. But of course, now the machines do not come with a CD that lets you reinstall the OS.
Sure, because they don't have, a lot of them don't have CD drives even.
Right, because Apple doesn't want to do that. Though I still have CD drives on both of my machines, though I suspect the next machines I get will not have them.
Yeah, it took me a couple of weeks to realize that my new Retina iMac does not have a DVD drive. And it was when I went to rip a movie. Now, to be fair, it was a Blu-ray, so I was going to use my external drive anyway. But it was like, hey, I can't put this in the side. That's all right. Good to go. Anyway.
Though it is cool you can do the remote CD thing. I have done that with an iMac.
I forgot about that.
Actually, I was able to do that, and that this was like totally geeking out. I was actually able to do this using the CD drive on a Windows machine. That there's something you can install on a Windows machine that'll let you do the remote CD thing cross-platform. It was pretty cool. When you have the need for CDs, I mean, the only thing I really use them for now is, yeah, if I'm ripping a movie.
Sure.
But anyways, so to his question, I think the best thing to do would be as follows. So with newer machines, I would first go into OS X recovery. Now, at first I thought, oh gosh, you know, his OS is kind of old there. I'm not sure if OS X recovery applies, but it does, at least according to Apple. You should have the ability to run it. They have a support article that talks about it, and they claim that Lion and Greater supports OS X recovery. So here's what I do. First, I would go into OS X recovery, and I would then run this utility. And the first thing I would do, what I would do is erase the drive, which you can do because you're booted into recovery. Normally you can't format the drive that you, you boot into.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that's silliness. But if you boot into recovery, you can do that. So what I would do is run this utility. And what you're going to see then is if you click on the drive, your main drive, and you go to erase, there's going to be some options. One is erase free space. I wouldn't bother with that. But then you're going to see another button here, and it varies what you're going to see in here based on the version of this utility, but you're going to see security options. And it's going to range from, or at least the one I'm looking at right now, it's going to range from fastest to most secure. And there's going to be like four levels here. I would probably not choose fastest because that doesn't, there's still the potential. If you then do an erase, there's the potential for people to recover your data. And we don't want that. So I would move it maybe one to the right. That's a better option because what happens there is when you do the erase, it's going to overwrite the drive with zeros. Now it's going to take a while, you know, but that's what I would do. Now, if you're really paranoid, now in theory, if somebody really knows what they're doing, they may be able to recover your data, even if you do a single pass. So they have one that will do more overwrites, but it takes much, much longer. I mean, this could take hours or maybe days if you choose one of these options. But if you have like state secrets or whatever, and you really want to be sure that it goes away and somebody cannot get it, I would choose one of the options to the farther right. I think the one of them, it'll overwrite the data 3 times, and then the other, it'll overwrite it 7 times. And these are like U.S. DOD standards, Department of Defense standards. So that's the first thing I would do, Dave.
Well, I'm going to stop you there, because all of that is correct on a spindle drive.
Yes. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because the thing is, the jury is out on how to, short of having a command that will do an erase of the SSD, any of these options may not erase everything on an SSD because of the way they allocate blocks.
Yeah, they probably won't. I don't think the jury's out on it. On that, I think the jury's in that will not erase everything on an SSD. What the jury's out on is how to erase everything on an SSD. There's an app. There's an app called Parted Magic for Windows that you can run in boot camp that a lot of people seem to think is the right way to deal with that. But man, yeah, it's not. The jury's out as far as I understand. Yeah.
So, but I'm almost sure that this machine has a rotational drive, sure, not an SSD.
Yeah. Right.
And then the second thing I would do is, once you erase the drive, using whichever security option, you choose, would then be to quit this utility. And then one of the other features in OS X recovery is install the OS. Now, you got to make sure you're connected to a network, because what it does is it downloads a copy of the appropriate OS. So either have to be connected via a wired or wireless connection. I'd probably choose wired to get speed, and reinstall the OS. And then the machine's all fresh and ready for whoever you want to sell it to. That's what I've done. Some people will leave stuff. I wouldn't recommend just like throwing away your home folder and stuff, because there could still be personal data scattered about.
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely.
So, when I've sold machines, I've always installed the latest OS. It's like, whoever you're selling it to, if they want to upgrade to the latest, that's their decision.
So wait, you just said when you've sold machines, you've always installed the latest OS. You mean you've installed the original OS?
No, I'm sorry. I misspoke. I'm sorry. Okay. I installed the original OS.
Okay.
I installed, like, for example, now my MacBook Pro, it has 10.5 on it, which is what it came with.
Got it.
So you can run Yosemite on it if you want to.
Yeah.
Not all the features are available, I think. Yeah, I think it's the oldest machine that it's possible to run Yosemite on. Anything older than that MacBook, you can't. Like, yeah, I think this machine, what did he say? Yeah, MacBook Pro 2007. Yeah, I don't think you could even run Yosemite. I think it'll refuse to install. So.
No, it'll run. I've got it running on one here.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it's Core 2 Duo, so it runs. Yeah. And actually, it runs fine. That's the machine. I have one of those that my son's using now, and that's the one that he turned the black. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Speaking of installing OSs and perhaps not installing the latest OS, let's take it to Felix and flip this problem on its head, John.
Yeah. All right. So here, Felix says, I'm interested in getting a new Mac Pro. Note, not MacBook Pro.
That's right. He's looking for
Mac Pro, as in the tube or the trash can like one. And I need it to run Mavericks, not Yosemite. Apple Store folks say that it won't run Mavericks. But I'm imagining that this would be because it's not possible within the OS to revert. If I were to clone my drive and clone that to the internal drive of the new Mac Pro, is there any reason to suspect that it would not run? And my response is as follows, Dave. I'm calling BS on the info that he got from the people at the Apple Store. I don't know why they said that you can't run it. They may not want him to, but the thing is, according, and so I checked my source here, at least according to Mac Tracker, the latest Mac Pro shipped with 10.9. And even according to Apple, you should be able to run Mavericks on a Mac Pro or later, looking at the system requirements. So I don't see any reason why cloning wouldn't work. You may want to test it and maybe do it on an external drive first, just to make sure that there's no hiccups. But I see no reason why you can't do that. So why did they say that?
They're wrong.
They're telling me.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I knew immediately when we saw Felix's email what it was. Pro Tools, which is a piece of software, especially Pro Tools HD, piece of software for recording, professional recording, like multi-track recording that you do in a music studio, runs much better under Mavericks right now. And actually a lot of people, and Felix even said that Logic is the same way, which is sort of interesting given that it's from Apple. But, you know, you want the processing horsepower of the Mac Pro, but you want to be able to run Pro Tools. Of course, it comes with Yosemite. And about 2 weeks before Felix's email came in, I got a phone call from one of my musical heroes, and he had just gotten a Mac Pro, and he needed to run Mavericks for Pro Tools, and he had gotten off the phone with Apple, and they told him, yeah, you can run Mavericks on it, no problem, you just have to get the installer, which of course is a trick. So I helped him get the installer. Felix found the same thing. Now, what Felix was able to do to get the installer was, he said he logged into his father's account and downloaded it from his dad's purchases history in order to then install it. I'm looking on my machine now, and in my purchases, I know I've had, I've had every OS that's been sold through the App Store, but I'm not seeing them in my purchases history. Now, I know there was a trick for getting them to come up. So maybe I'm missing that trick. And if I am, maybe somebody in the chat room will help us, but that's where you can get it from. Or if you were smart enough, or had a friend who was smart enough to archive off the installer for a previous version of OS X, that would work too. I save them all on my disk station because you never know when you're going to need one of those things. And it's handy to have an archive of that stuff around. Speaking of our chat room, I want to say hi to everyone in the chat room at MacGeekGab.com/stream. Chris Humphreys in the chat room heard us talking before. He has a Mac Mini running a Fusion drive and did some disk write and read tests with Blackmagic speed test for us. And he said he was getting 260 megabyte per second writes and 413 megabyte per second reads. So those are fine speeds. I don't know what generation Mac Mini it is or any of that, but I know on my new Retina iMac with the SSD in there, I'm getting about, I think it was about 700 megabytes per second down or writing and reading. So not as fast as an SSD proper, I don't think. But it's hard to say, you know, what it would compare to with an SSD in that machine, but still plenty fast and much faster than you would get with a spindle drive, I would think. So that's not bad. Not bad. Thank you for doing that, Chris.
Yeah. And someone brought up also in the chat room, someone brought up a good point here is that, you know, if you do a clone, you want to make sure that you, cause I think the clone would actually initially blast the recovery partition. But I think both Carbon Copy Cloner and Super Duper have facilities to install the proper recovery for the OS that you're running.
I know Carbon Copy Cloner does. I don't know that Super Duper does. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Carbon Copy Cloner has taken a step ahead these days. I'm using it exclusively now for all of my non-Time Machine backups. I do my daily clone with with Carbon Copy Cloner. And then I also do I mentioned before I have my music library on a spindle drive. I also like to back that up. And so I clone that daily to my disk station, which is what my Sonos reads from and DS Audio and all that reads from. So I have an updated copy of my music library out there too. So.
Yeah, I did Carbon Copy Cloner. I think, what are they on 4.0 now? Yeah, they redid the UI, added some nice features.
Yeah.
My favorite.
I'm really impressed with it. Yeah. It does a great job, like you said, with the recovery partitions, but But yeah, the UI is great. And the way you can kind of string things together, I have, like I said, I have both of these scripts run daily. And so I have it run the first one, and then I actually have the first one set to trigger the second one so that they're never trying to run at the same time, but they both get, you know, they both get things done. So yeah, it's good stuff.
Of course, another question, just in the realm of installing OSs or older OSs especially, which is seems to be a theme here, is I don't know about you, Dave, but I have I've saved the installers for several versions back.
Well, that's what I was saying. I save them all on my disk station. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, good. All right. The other way, so we actually had someone, you know, ask that question, I think, in a random email, and another answer is, how do I get an older, well, another answer is, how do you get an older OS? Well, you join the developer program.
Oh, do they have them all there?
Last I checked, yeah, they have,
of course,
yeah, they go back.
They would, yeah.
Because as a developer, you should probably be testing your, you should probably be testing your stuff on OS's going back a couple
yeah, versions. Okay, so I am seeing OS 10 Lion out here in my purchases list. I just wasn't looking carefully for it. I haven't found Mavericks, but maybe it's out there. But yeah, you're right. I forgot about the developer program having that. Yes, very good. Good stuff. All right. Back in show 538, John, we were talking about Wi-Fi speeds and all of that good stuff. And listener Paul wrote in and asked, he said, how are you testing your Wi-Fi speeds? We were talking about power line versus wireless extenders and how I was, checking the speeds internal to my network. And the speeds that I was getting were, the point was to test to make sure I could get speeds faster than my internet connection would allow. Not only because I want everybody to have, you know, the full unfettered access to the full speeds of the internet that we have, but also because of backups and beaming movies around. Like I said, you know, I keep a lot of stuff on the disk station. I want to be able to beam that stuff to the Apple TV without having bandwidth issues or anything. And so speed test and websites like that are great for measuring your internet speed, as long as you know that your network in your house or your office is running at full speed. And the question that Paul has is, how do you test that? I found that there's basically one tool that's good for this, and it's called iPerf. Now, iPerf is not automatically installed on your Mac. And the idea behind, I'll tell you how to get it on there, but the idea behind iPerf is you run it on two Macs in two different places on your network. And one of them sets up as a server, and that is, I believe, the sender. And then the other you connect as the client. And by default, it'll send a 10-second burst of traffic. And the nice part is it's just dummy traffic that it's generating in software. So you're not going to be limited by the speed of a disk, say, that it's reading data from, you know, copying from the Finder from one computer to the other. Won't necessarily test your network if your drive on one side or the other is slower than the maximum of your network. So the nice part about this is it's just blasting data. And then when the data gets to the destination, it receives it and throws it away. So there's no other, really, it's just the network pipe, unless you've got some CPU problems, which can be an issue at times, but probably not on your Macs today. Maybe if you've got iPerf on your router. There's a couple ways to install iPerf. There is a command line tool, meaning it's built to be run from like the terminal on your Mac, but someone has released it someone built a Java wrapper for it. That actually is kind of nice because it shows you some graphs and things like that. And that's called JPerf, for lack of a better term. And that we'll put a link to where that lives in the show notes. But if you aren't afraid of the terminal, that really is the best way to run it. And you can install it with Homebrew. And Homebrew, we mentioned in the last show, it's a super easy package manager. And by package manager, what we mean is a piece of software that allows you to install other software easily. the App Store, the Mac App Store on your computer is a package manager. It allows you to install other software easily, and it manages that for you. Brew is another one, and it does things that the Mac App Store will not do, like terminal-based programs like iPerf. Go to brew.sh. There is a single line that you copy and paste. We mentioned in the last show. That'll get Brew set up on your machine. And then you just say brew space install space iPerf. Now, if you're going to do it this way, don't do the command I just said. Do brew space install space iPerf 3. That's the latest version of iPerf. It is not compatible with iPerf 2. You could install both. And in fact, for some of you, you might want to, depending on, you know, what you've got elsewhere. And then on one Mac that you're going to use as a server, you just type iPerf 3 space dash S and boom, you're good to go. And on a Mac that you want to, that the client, it's iPerf 3 space dash C because you're the client. And then you put in the IP address of the other one and it'll blast data. We'll write this stuff up. We'll put up an article about this because it's good stuff. And you know, there you go. So that's all I got. Use iPerf, John?
On occasion. Yeah, like when, you know, I was proving to myself that jumbo packets are better.
Yes.
I used it.
Oh, really? And did you see a measurable difference?
I'm going to convince myself that I did.
Confirmation bias is a wonderful, wonderful thing, isn't it?
Yes. I don't know if... No, the thing is, I would see greater speeds, but I don't know if they were in... They could have been within the realm of either measurement error or just the randomness of you know, TCP/IP, is that you won't get the same throughput. Even, you know, because even everything else, well, if everything else was the same, then you would. But the thing is, you know, there are variables.
Right.
In TCP/IP performance.
Right. Yeah. You won't get exactly the same numbers every time you run iPerf. But you should, it should be somewhere close. Yeah. It's interesting. It's how I know that I have a full gigabit pipe between the office and the studio and, you know, I do between the office and the studio, but they're just one's above the other, but I have it between the office and the house too. So,
yeah. Now the poor man's measurement tool, there's another tool you could use, Dave, and it's built right into the operating system.
What's
that? An activity monitor.
Well, it shows you
go to activity monitor. And then, I would say in the network tab, it'll show you network throughput. Now it's
right.
Not a benchmarking tool. It'll give you, you know, what I've done, you know, if you want to do it quick and dirty, is you get a large file, you copy it from one machine to another, and then you check the throughput. And that's, you know, another way to measure it, though it's, you know, not.
Yeah, but like I said before, that's
a better way.
That's actually a terrible way, because what are you measuring? Are you measuring the speed of your network? Are you measuring the speed of the drive you're reading from? Are you measuring the speed of the drive you're writing to?
Right.
Right.
Good point.
And that's the that's where something like iPerf is handy. Now, if you want to test your Wi-Fi speeds with your iPhone, there recently became a piece of software that runs iPerf 2 and iPerf 3 on your iPhone. And it is Network Tools from Hurricane Electric, and it is available for free. So we will find and put the link for that in the show notes. But yeah, so you can do that too. Fun stuff. Have you tried the Hurricane Electric tools, John?
No.
Oh, it's good stuff.
No, I'm using their, you know, IPv6 tunnel.
Right. That's right. Yeah, yeah. It seems weird that a company called Hurricane Electric would be so involved in this, but they are. So yeah. All right. Let's see. Where are we on time here? You know what? I want to talk about our second sponsor, John, which is Barebones Software is the name of the company. And it's barebones.com. Barebones, these folks have been making software, well, longer than we've been making podcasts, which is actually saying something these days. Because, you know, I was thinking about it in the shower the other day, John. We started this podcast before the iPhone, before the Apple Watch. I mean, there's a whole list of things, right? But not before Bare Bones, not even close. We didn't start Mac Observer before Bare Bones. Those guys were rock stars before Mac Observer was even a twinkle. They've been doing this a long time. And they started with a piece of software called BB Edit that is a killer text editor. We talked about it a lot on this show. And if you need to edit text, or really if you just need to manipulate or work with text, BB Edit is definitely something you want to check out. I also really, really like Yojimbo, which isn't quite as old as MacKey. Well, maybe it is. I'm trying to remember. It might be. It's about in that range. Yojimbo is a piece of software for maintaining all your stuff, bits and pieces of information. You want to throw PDFs in here. You want to throw little notes. You want to throw RTFD files, right? That files that have metadata, or not metadata, but rich data in them. This is an Apple only construct, but it's awesome. It's what we use for the show agenda. We have audio files and text and all of it in an RTFD file. You can create them in text edit, but you can also create them right inside of Yojimbo. I store my serial numbers in here. Yojimbo will sync, not using iCloud, because iCloud syncing proved to be unreliable for third-party apps like this. So they've got their own syncing engine that they've partnered with, and it works brilliantly. I've got it syncing amongst four Macs, my three iMacs and my MacBook Air, and that works great. You can have little collections of things. So I have a Mac Geek Gab collection, and that just syncs across too. So if I put stuff in the Mac Geek Gab collection on my iMac in the office, I come up to the studio and the data is just right here. It works fantastically well. So I recommend you check them both out. Actually, you can go to barebones.com and download trials of both of these, and you can buy them right there. When you're ready to roll. So check it all out, barebones.com. Please check it out and figure out which one of their packages that I mentioned, BB Edit or Yojimbo, is your favorite of the Bare Bones software offerings these days. And let us know. You can email us feedback at MacGeekGab.com, of course, is the place to find us. You can find us MacGeekGab on Twitter. Let us know what you like, and we'd love to hear about it. So thank you to Barebones at barebones.com for sponsoring the show. And thank you, all of our listeners, for checking out their software. All right, John, let's see what we got here. I haven't been crossing things off. Oh, David has a question. Let's let David take it away.
Hey, John, Dave, this is David from Raleigh, North Carolina at Main Street Apple. And a question for you. I have all my movie collections in iTunes, and it is sitting on a external hard drive off of my Apple Express router. And what I typically do is have all the movies sitting just in a file folder, and then I drag them into iTunes to add it to the iTunes library. And that typically always works fine. But now I drag it over to add it to the iTunes library, which is residing on the same external hard drive as the actual physical movies are, the iTunes database, that is. And so it shows it copying it in the progress bar, the movie into the iTunes library, and then it completes, and then it doesn't show up anywhere in the database. I refresh, I quit, or, you know, open it back up, nothing. So I don't know what's causing this. I think the hard drive's fine. I'm not having any performance issues with the hard drive itself. It seems to be something with the iTunes library and its indexing or something like that. So I don't know if you have any solutions for that. So then part B to all this is I thought about maybe moving the database to Plex. And I wondered if you guys could speak to that, if you got to jailbreak the Apple TVs to work with Plex, or if Plex will see it through some other app or something like that on there, because that's basically how I serve up all my movies is through Apple TV, which is pointing to the iTunes library on the external hard drive hanging off my router. This is where you cut me off. You can reach.
All right, and we will cut you off. Thank you. Yeah. So two questions, really. The first being how to go about repairing the iTunes. I mean, I think it sounds like the library file is just damaged, right, John? I mean, he's dragging the movie in, it's going through the process of adding the movie, unless it's putting it somewhere that he can't find it, or he's not looking in the right spot. I know I believe as a version 11 with iTunes, any movies that you drag in, even if it's a commercial movie that you've gotten the DVD or the Blu-ray and you ripped it on your own and put it in, those typically were showing up in the home movies section. So it's possible it's actually there, just not exactly where you would think. And I know you ran into some of that too, right, John?
I know we had a question about the movies. At one point, movies got recategorized,
right?
And people were shaking their fists and writing in saying, "Well, what happened? Where did they go?"
Right. So that, it's possible that's what's going on. If not, then you know it's worth. I hate to say blow away your iTunes library and recreate it, but it might be worth creating a separate iTunes library. If you launch iTunes with the option key held down, you get three options. One is to quit. And then the other two are to either create a library or choose a secondary library. Create a secondary library just for testing purposes and drag one of these movies in and just find it, right? It should be a lot easier to see what's happened because you don't have all your other stuff in there too. And this may either show you where it is, and hopefully you find it in the same spot in your main library, and then you can just throw away this other library file. Or it will show you that your library is, in fact, damaged in some way. If it is damaged, then there's a process you can go through of recreating the library from itself. You may not lose everything. There are kind of little backups that iTunes saves. I'm not going to go through the process here. There's a knowledge base article that makes it a lot easier than anything we could explain audibly here. But that would be the next thing to try is sort of recreating the library before just blowing it away and truly starting from scratch and, re-adding everything. That's my thoughts. You have any thoughts on that, John, before we move on to the kind of the second part of his question here?
No, I don't use iTunes for managing my movies.
So what do you use for managing your movies?
The few movies that I have are on the disc station.
Okay, and so you just manage those with? Do you use Plex on the disc station, or do you use just
nope.
their built-in stuff?
No, just put the MP4 file in. I just put it in the video folder and. That's what I do. I don't really have a lot of rip movies, but when I do that's what I do. I like their solution.
I do the same thing, John. I have lots of rip movies and we exclusively watch things from the disc station. It just makes life easier. We pretty much use their own video station and companion apps, DS Video, because they work so well with the Apple TV. You just tell it, okay, there's no interface from the Apple TV to go tell it to start the movie from the disc station because there's no third party apps on the Apple TV. However, once you get it started, the disc station will stream directly to the Apple TV. You can use your phone to control it, but once you get it started, you can actually use the remote on the Apple TV to control it. And it's not streaming through your phone. There's no echoing of that. You could take your phone and turn it off or leave the premises. And as long as the disc station is still there, it's going to stream to your Apple TV because that's what it's doing. I do also run Plex on the disc station. We use that less and less because the built-in stuff works, but Plex works. The one thing Plex lacks is the ability to do that direct streaming. You have to go through AirPlay. Now you could go through AirPlay from your Mac. You could go through AirPlay from your iOS device and it works. It actually works quite well, but you are doing that, kind of double duty on your network. If you've got enough network speed on your local network, then it doesn't matter. But you will be, using either one of your computers, which is if you're running Plex on your Mac, then that's fine. You can just, AirPlay from there to your Apple TV if your computer's got the juice to do that, or you can do it from your iPhone, and it works fine. iTunes, it's not the best way to manage your movies. I've found it's a little clunky. In fact, it's more than a little clunky. It needs an overhaul. But we've talked about that. It's a tough spot for Apple, right? It's not an easy thing for them to overhaul these days. You want to take us to Adam, John?
Okay. Well, all right. Adam. All right. Adam has a head scratcher here, and I think I got an answer. I hope I got an answer. Yeah, this is a harder problem than I thought. So Adam writes, thank you for the podcast. It's lots of fun and informative.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening. I have a new problem. And that's what we're all about. In Mail App 7.3 under OS 10.9.5, I inadvertently built a smart mailbox in a mailbox folder that referenced the mailbox folder it's located inside of. That must have created some sort of circular logic loop, and now mail crashes every time I try to open it. I have a Time Machine backup from prior, but I'm not sure what plist or other preference files contains the smart mailbox descriptions. I have dug through library mail v2 mail data and library preferences, replacing and removing files in hope of mail rebuilding clean ones, all to no avail. Each launch mail tells me it crashed the previous launch while trying to open windows and asks if I should skip opening them. I never saw these windows, but I tell it not to open them and then it crashes again. If I had to, I could blow away everything and start over. The mail is all on a remote IMAP server, but I'd like to not have to rebuild the 20 or 30 rolls and the dozen or so smart mailboxes that I had. Okay. So I thought this would be simple, Dave, but I think something complicates this. So first, I tried the old trick of trying to find using the Finder's advanced search to locate a recently changed plist file. And so, you know, I created a smart mailbox and then looked for a plist file that got modified. And I didn't find any, or I found something, but I didn't find what I wanted. I actually found something in iCloud/mail/mail data. And I'm like, huh? And it was called like ubiquitous smart mailbox sync or something.
Yeah. Do you know the bell that goes off every time you see ubiquitous? Are you gonna take us there? Right, because ubiquitous means ubiquity agent put it there, or ubiquity agent manages it, and it's iCloud.
Right.
Right? Yep.
But at least it led me to the plist files that sure. You should be editing or that contain these. And so so that gave me a clue. So then I looked, Dave, in home directory /library/mail/v2/mail data. And I saw what I think are two candidates for the smart mailboxes. One is called smart mailboxes local properties.plist, and the other is called synced smart mailboxes.plist. Yeah, as you're suggesting, that also kind of suggests iCloud. I'm like, oh, well, let me just whack those files and see what happens. And I whacked them and started up mail, and sure enough, the smart mailboxes reappeared. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
How is this happening? And then all of a sudden I realized, oh, like you said, iCloud. Yep. So I think what you're going to need to do, so I'm assuming that you have iCloud enabled, and one of the things that iCloud does in the background is it will sync many features of mail across different installations, one of them being smart mailboxes. If you have it on one, it'll sync to your other mail clients. So I think what you have to do is first go into iCloud/iCloud in system preferences.
Yep.
iCloud Drive, at least currently,
right.
And then mail, and there's a checkbox. And I think what you want to do is you want to uncheck that so that you can then whack these and it'll take hold. Now, you may want to copy them first because, I think you have to be careful here because he said that he didn't want to blast all of them. So I think what you may have to do is save those plist files off somewhere and then copy and paste the rules once you've cleared things out.
It can be I want to point out two things. You said it right, but I want to reiterate, when you get to mm-hmm. iCloud, there's a mail checkbox right there. That's not the one that's controlling the syncing of the data. That's just adding your iCloud mail account.
Right.
So you said it right, but I just want to make it clear. You've got to go to iCloud Drive, and then within there, there's a list of all the apps that are syncing their preferences, for lack of a better term. And that's not accurate with everything, but with mail it is. And that's where you turn that off is in that box. But like you said, it gets weird. I've been through this a couple of times, and I've had to, sometimes I have to like make the edits and then manually roll them to all of my other Macs so that they, you know, those files appear. You can also mess with it. If you go into the iCloud Drive folder, and now I think you've got to go there in the terminal because you don't always see this stuff out there.
Yeah, I noticed that too. They're like that plist file that I found.
Yeah.
It's in iCloud/mail/mail data. But when I looked in iCloud Drive, there's no mail directory. But if you type it in manually,
yeah,
you can get there. Yeah, it's very strange how it hides a lot of the iCloud stuff from you in the Finder.
Right. So yeah, if you go in the terminal, and I swear there's a way to get there in the Finder too and have it show you the hidden files, but certainly if you go in the terminal to the library mobile documents folder, you will see tons of things there. And they've all got kind of weird serialized beginnings. And then, I think we just had a power flicker here. That's not good. Weird little serialized beginnings. And then, you know, the reverse DNS of whatever the app is. So you should be able to find it, you know, com/apple/mail is what it is. And I think it's a folder, right? And so if you go into that folder, so if you in the Finder, let's see if this will work. Real time testing here. You go to the go menu, you say go to folder, and you type in /library/mobile/documents/MD, and then a slash, and then all lowercase com/apple/mail. No, it won't show it to you in the Finder. In fact, I get an icon I've never seen before. It says iCloud for mail. You can move your existing documents to iCloud by dragging them here from the Finder or other apps. Dang it. So you got to go there in the terminal or use some third party app, maybe like Pathfinder, right? Would get there. I don't have that installed on this machine to test, but that would be the other way. So yeah, that's where you can go. And then you go into the data folder inside that, and maybe in mail data. Yeah, that's where you find it. Yep. Ubiquitous synced rules and ubiquitous synced smart mailboxes. Yeah. So maybe Pathfinder. You run Pathfinder, John?
No.
You used to, right?
No, I run Total Finder.
Total Finder. That's it. Okay. Yep. Yep.
Yeah, I like Total Finder. They introduced a few features before Apple did in the Finder.
And do you still run that as your main kind of Finder thing? Really?
Yeah.
Well, so I think we're done. Are we done with Adam? Because I want to ask you about Total Finder. I'm actually curious about this, but let's finish with Adam first.
No, I think we're done. And okay. Actually, I think there's one other. So he was asking. There's also one other file I didn't mention. So it's also smartmailboxes.plist. So it looks like there's three files where all that stuff is stored. So, yeah. So, this can get squirrely, though. But the problem is, iCloud's the problem here is that it's doing what I think it should. It's like, oh, yeah, you want me to restore that for you? Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, right? Right. Data is missing. I have it. Let me help. Right. Yeah. It's sort of broken. Please don't help. And we've seen that before.
Then, right. Oh my gosh, I'm seeing even more. I'm looking on my USA. I see another version of smartmailboxes.plist. Oh my gosh. It looks like there's four plist files that have to do with smart mailboxes. What a mess.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. You know, and I do want to get to this Total Finder thing, but while we're on the subject of iCloud syncing stuff, iCloud syncs iOS data preferences too, or app preferences, including some preferences for system level components. And we mentioned this years ago when we stumbled onto it, but it's worth mentioning again. All that stuff is also synced to your Mac. Your Mac doesn't use it, but the data is there in that folder. And my son was having a problem with his iPhone and it was terrible. It would, you know, reboot all the time. So Apple actually replaced it for him. And the same thing started happening without him restoring any of his stuff, but he did log into his iCloud account. And it turns out it was a bad file. You know, he had some bad preference file for the system that was being synced to his phone by iCloud. So he got a new phone out of it, which was nice, but you know, so it's worth, we'll put an article up about managing that, but, But yeah, it, you know, that data can get in the way. So that's one way of managing it. So, but Total Finder, John, tell me about it. Give me, you know, give me the elevator pitch on why you like it. What you use it for? Cause I'm really curious about this.
I think I initially got into it because it offered something that you always wanted, Finder with tabs.
Yeah, that's right.
I think it was that's what caused me to look at it, because it was when they introduced it, it was a unique feature. The other thing that they offer now, actually in Yosemite, a lot of people had a fish shake over this, is that in Yosemite, it will give you colored labels, which they kind of broke in Yosemite. And a lot
right.
of people were shaking their fists. So that's another thing that they figured out. So, and it does, you know, some nice colorization of the icons in the sidebar and stuff like that. So,
does this completely?
Yeah, I've always liked it.
Go ahead. Sorry. I was going to say, does this completely replace Finder for you? Like, do you ever run Finder, or does this sort of turn Finder off?
You run it when you start your machine up or put it in the login items, and then it runs instead of Finder, though I'm sure, you know, it ties into.
Sure.
So it enhances Finder.
I think it's a separate app entirely, though, right? I mean, it's not Finder. That's pretty cool. Huh?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, if you hover over the Finder icon in the OS, it'll say Finder. It doesn't say Total Finder.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
But it's different. You can tell you're running it because actually when you see it in the dock, it actually has a little tab.
Got it.
You know, like a folder tab, whereas the regular Finder icon is, you know, just the square with the smiley.
Yeah, I see the, Hey, how do they get away with that?
Yeah, and they do some other things here. Actually, I'm looking right now. So some of the other things that are really cool about a Total Finder.
Yeah.
So file browser, they have a file browser section. You can show system files, which is kind of nice.
Oh, because
normally they're hidden.
Well, does that help? Does that work in this iCloud folder?
No, you know, it didn't. Yeah. They effectively, shielded that stuff. But for example, now I'm clicking on it and you know, the folder that I happen to be in, actually, when I click on show system files, it shows .ds_store, which is, you know, a hidden system file.
Yeah. Right. Right. Fascinating. Cool. All right. Yeah. I'm wondering how they get away with using that. Well, I guess they're not in the App Store. So that's how they get away with using Apple's logo. Cause remember we had, excuse me, with Mac Geek Gab, we had the Finder icons in the logos of the glasses, or in the lenses of the glasses on the Mac Geek Gab logo. And as soon as we submitted the app to the iOS store years ago, they were like, no, you can't do that. Like, what? Like, oh, no. That's an Apple. That's Apple IP. Like, oh yeah. Didn't even think about it. All right, we got one last one. And while we're on the subject of Finder, this is a great way to tie it together. Bill writes in, he says, I have three drives that are usually mounted to my MacBook Pro mid-2012 15-inch. Suddenly, they have disappeared from the Finder sidebar. I can see them when I open Disk Utility, so I know they are connected. In fact, I first discovered the issue when I looked at the sidebar, saw that they weren't there, assumed that they were unmounted, so I pulled the USB plug. I go to Finder Preferences and see that hard disks and external disks are both checked in the sidebar panel. I tried unchecking them, rebooting, then checking them again. They still don't appear. Meanwhile, I decided to finally upgrade from Mavericks to Yosemite, and I thought that with a new OS, that would fix it. No, again. I ran Onyx, and again, no change. I'm stumped. Any thoughts? Well, I've seen this. It's not uncommon. And the only way... So. You can still see them in the Finder. If you go again in the Finder, back to that Go menu that we just mentioned, and go to Computer, you should see all of your disks listed there, including and an option for network. But you should see all the disks connected to your computer there. From here, double click on one of them so that you're now seeing the disk. That might get it to show up in the device's sidebar, but it might not. If it does not, go up and grab the icon from the title bar of the window. So, you know, you've got the contents of the window, then you've got the toolbar. Above that is an icon and then the name. Grab the icon itself and drag that over to the devices section. And that will put it back there in most cases. That also works with network drives if you want to have them in like you know, your shared section or your favorites or whatever, or even in devices. It's a weird UI thing. There is, to my knowledge, there is no other way to do this, which is wonky because it's completely undocumented, but it does work. And that's, you know, I guess that's the most important thing is that it works. So, in fact, I'm going to do it right now because I want my movies drive to show up there. And so now I just dragged it over and now my movies drive shows up. It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know why they call it Finder. It seems it doesn't sometimes do a very good job of helping you find things.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It's crazy.
Well, no, it does. No, I got to say, it does a very nice job of obscuring, of only showing you the important parts of the underlying Unix file system, right?
That's true. Yeah, as much as we complain about it, I would not want to see all those DS store files. I would, you know, all the time. So, but it's good to know how to get around it when you need to. That's the important part. So, yeah, I got to find an app, and I thought maybe Total Finder would be it, but maybe it's Pathfinder. I got to find something to manage that kind of stuff in a graphical way. Although I'm quite comfortable with the terminal. But there are things that are just simpler to do and more efficient to do in a GUI. So I got to check that out. I don't know. It's always something. It's fun though, because it, you know, keeps us doing what we're doing. Hey, there's the band. It's that time, John.
Wow, I'm surprised they're able to play.
It's early
in this frigid weather.
That's crazy.
They're not frozen.
Would you like to build a snowman? Speaking of frozen, John?
Would you like to? Oh, I've seen some hilarious parodies.
Yeah.
One was like a coffee-based one. Would you like to get some coffee?
That's awesome.
They have some, yeah, really, really funny spinoffs. Oh, my gosh, though. Especially this during the holiday season, I was like overwhelmed with Frozen paraphernalia. It was like everywhere. It's like everybody wants to be a princess. Everybody wants Frozen stuff.
Oh yeah.
Even our library, actually, I think they took it down. Our local library did Frozen decorations on the door. I hope they don't get sued.
Yeah, who's gonna sue a library?
I've heard you know, some companies, Disney and others,
you got to protect your
intellectual property.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. I think they've even, you know, shaken down, you know, like I've seen, you know, like element or, you know, like preschool and stuff. They, you know, paint things and they're like, you got to kind of license that or
take it down.
Yeah. You got to protect your rights.
Yeah, you have to. That's right. Because if they don't protect them with the library, then when somebody uses it for something else, those other people can say, well, you didn't protect it with the library. So therefore, it's now fair use. That's right. Furby's is saying in the chat room that Tinker Tool may be the magic answer for showing system files and that sort of thing. So I'll have to check that out. Thanks, Furby's. All right.
Yeah.
I mentioned it once before, but I will say it again. feedback@macgeekab.com is the address to which you can send all of whatever you want to send us, including, you know, your favorite Lynda course and your favorite Barebones apps. Please, I mean it. I would love to hear what courses you folks are using. I know we've heard from some of you, but I would love to hear from all of you.
I don't know, Dave. I like to think outside of the box, and I prefer to send email to feedback@macgeekab.com.
Yeah, I know how it is. 206-666 Geek is the address. John, and Geek is
4335.
And
but
John,
we are also,
go ahead.
We're also on the Twitters. And actually, you know, I went back to my favorite Twitter client. They had a bug. They had a bug that they fixed. Yorufukoru, now they call it Night Owl. But yeah, I'm still running Twitterific, actually, on my iOS devices. But they fixed it. Nice. You know, I think I told you, you know, I tried to add an account, and it was violently crashing.
Yeah.
They finally fixed it.
Oh, that's good.
So that's nice. But speaking of the Twitters, if you want to tweet with us, I am John Epron. He is Dave Hamilton. That other guy is Pilot Pete. The podcast is Mac Geek Gab, and the publication is Mac Observer, all at twitter.com. But there's more, Dave.
Yeah, I our mugs are actually being produced as we speak for all of the folks that qualified both all the way up through a couple of weeks ago, I guess, was the cutoff date. The newly revised cutoff date, because things took so long to come around. But the mugs are being produced as we speak. And I believe we've got everybody's addresses, so hopefully those will start going out. They might actually start going out this week. I think they'll be back in the fulfillment house shortly, snow permitting, because our fulfillment house is right here in Massachusetts. So,
Sweet.
Things get slowed down all right. at times. But yeah.
I think there's one person. Yeah, I sent out the email. You know, I always cringe before I do a MailChimp campaign.
Sure.
Well, because one time I sent one out and I got the fields wrong, so it was all mangled. And I'm like, oh, no. Oh, I blew it. MailChimp's pretty cool, though.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. Yeah. Yep. All right. So premium at MacGeekUp.com is the address that all of you that are premium supporters, whether you've hit the tier for a mug this time around or not, premium at MacGeekUp.com is the address that you can use. I would like to thank all of you for listening. I really like to thank all of you that are premium members. You can find out about that at MacGeekGab.com. We really do truly appreciate your support, and I'm sincerely apologetic and just truly sorry about how long it took to get the mugs around. And I'm thankful for how understanding and frankly how much of a non-event that kind of thing is for all of you. Your support shines through in those moments, and the real reason for the premium program really is made evident to us. So it's humbling. Thank you. We really do appreciate your support. I want to also thank Michael Johnston. He produces the iOS show. He's the host of the iOS show, and he also converts this show to AAC for all of us and all of you, adding those chapters that I know you love. And, I want to thank Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. In our podcast marketplace this month, of course, Lynda, LYNDA.com/MGG, Barebones.com, at Barebones Software there, of course, Drobo.com, MGG50, I think that coupon code still works. Use it, though, because I don't think it's going to last forever. Squarespace.com/MGG, Gazelle.com, we're all selling off all your stuff. And of course, the people that make the software we can't live without, Smile at smilesoftware.com. John, I'm not sure when we're doing the next show, but I think it's certainly going to be before Sunday, because I'm on an airplane Sunday, weather permitting. I think we're recording Friday afternoon. But between now and the next time we record, folks, have a splendid week. And please don't get caught.
Made up.